Chapter 131. Consent. You never should do what you threaten now. Apostrophe. Will you prevent me? Apostrophe. Apostrophe. Asked Sir Mulberry, with a laugh. Yes, if I can. Apostrophe. Returned the other, promptly. A very proper saving clause, that last. Apostrophe. Said Sir Mulberry, and one you stand in need of. Oh, look to your own business, and leave me to look to mine. Apostrophe. This is mine. Apostrophe. Retorted Lord Frederick. I make it mine. I will make it mine. It's mine already. I am more calm promised than I should be, as it is. Apostrophe. Do as you please, and what you please, for yourself. Apostrophe. Said Sir Mulberry, affecting an easy good humor. Surely that must content you. Do nothing for me, that's all. I advise no man to interfere in proceedings that I choose to take. I am sure you know me better than to do so. The fact is, I see, you mean to offer me advice. It is well meant, I have no doubt, but I reject it. Now, if you please, we will return to the carriage. I find no entertainment here, but quite the reverse. If we prolong this conversation, we might quarrel, which would be no proof of wisdom in either you or me. Apostrophe. With this rejoinder, and waiting for no further discussion, Sir Mulberry Hawk yawned, and very leisurely turned back. There was not a little tact and knowledge of the young lord's disposition in this mode of treating him. Sir Mulberry clearly saw that, if his dominion were to last, it must be established now. He knew that the moment he became violent, the young man would become violent too. He had, many times, been enabled to strengthen his influence, when any circumstance had occurred to weaken it, by adopting this cool and laconic style, and he trusted to it now, with very little doubt of its entire success. But while he did this, and wore the most careless and indifferent deportment that his practiced arts enabled him to assume, he inwardly resolved not only to visit all the mortification of being compelled to suppress his feelings, with additional severity upon Nicholas, but also to make the young lord pay dearly for it, one day, in some shape or other. So long as he had been a passive instrument in his hands, Sir Mulberry had regarded him with no other feeling than contempt. But, now that he presumed to avow opinions in opposition to his, and even to turn upon him with a lofty tone and an air of superiority, he began to hate him. Conscious that, in the vilest and most worthless sense of the term, he was dependent upon the weak young lord, Sir Mulberry could the less brook humiliation at his hands, and when he began to dislike him, he measured his dislike as men often do by the extent of the injuries he had inflicted upon its object. When it is remembered that Sir Mulberry Hawk had plundered, duped, deceived, and fooled his pupil in every possible way, it will not be wondered at that, beginning to hate him, he began to hate him cordially. On the other hand, the young lord, having thought which he very seldom did about anything and seriously too, upon the affair with Nicholas, and the circumstances which led to it, had arrived at a manly and honest conclusion. Sir Mulberry's coarse and insulting behavior on the occasion in question had produced a deep impression on his mind. A strong suspicion of his having led him on to pursue Miss Nickleby for purposes of his own, had been lurking there for some time. He was really ashamed of his share in the transaction, and deeply mortified by the misgiving that he had been gulled. He had had sufficient leisure to reflect upon these things during their late retirement, and, at times, when his careless and indolent nature would permit, had availed himself of the opportunity. Slight circumstances, too, had occurred to increase his suspicion. It wanted but a very slight circumstance to kindle his wrath against Sir Mulberry. This his disdainful and insolent tone in their recent conversation, the only one they had held upon the subject since the period to which Sir Mulberry referred, affected. Thus they rejoined their friends, each with causes of dislike against the other rankling in his breast. And the young man haunted, Besides, with thoughts of the vindictive retaliation which was threatened against Nicholas, and the determination to prevent it by some strong step, if possible. But this was not all. Sir Mulberry, conceiving that he had silenced him effectually, could not suppress his triumph, or forbear from following up what he conceived to be his advantage. Mr. Pike was there, and Mr. Pluck was there, and Colonel Chaucer, and other gentlemen of the same cast, and it was a great point for Sir Mulberry to show them that he had not lost his influence. At first, the young lord contented himself with a silent determination to take measures for withdrawing himself from the connection immediately. By degrees, he grew more angry, and was exasperated by jests and familiarities which, a few hours before, would have been a source of amusement to him. This did not serve him, for, at such bantering a retort as suited the company, he was no match for Sir Mulberry. Still, no violent rupture took place. They returned to town, Messrs. Pike and Pluck and other gentlemen frequently protesting, on the way thither, that Sir Mulberry had never been in such tip-top spirits in all his life. They dined together, sumptuously. The wine flowed freely, as indeed it had done all day. Sir Mulberry drank to recompense himself for his recent abstinence, the young lord, to drown his indignation, and the remainder of the party, because the wine was of the best, and they had nothing to pay. It was nearly midnight when they rushed out, wild, burning with wine, their blood boiling, and their brains on fire, to the gaming table. Here, they encountered another party, mad like themselves. The excitement of play, hot rooms, and glaring lights was not calculated to allay the fever of the time. In that giddy whirl of noise and confusion, the men were delirious. Who thought of money, ruin, or the morrow, in the savage intoxication of the moment? More wine was called for, glass after glass was drained, their parched and scalding mouths were cracked with thirst. Down poured the wine like oil on blazing fire. And still the riot went on. The debauchery gained its height. Glasses were dashed upon the floor by hands that could not carry them to lips. Oaths were shouted out by lips which could scarcely form the words to vent them in. Drunken losers cursed and roared. Some mounted on the tables, waving bottles above their heads and bidding defiance to the rest. Some danced, some sang, some tore the cards and raved. Tumult and frenzy reigned supreme. When the noise arose that drowned all others, and two men, seizing each other by the throat, struggled into the middle of the room. A dozen voices, until now unheard, called aloud to part them. Those who had kept themselves cool, to win, and who earned their living in such scenes, threw themselves upon the combatants, and, forcing them asunder, dragged them some space apart. "Let me go!" cried Sir Mulberry, in a thick, hoarse voice. "He struck me. Do you hear? I say, he struck me. Have I a friend here? Who is this? Westwood. Do you hear me say he struck me? I hear, replied one of those who held him. Come away for tonight. I will not, by G, he replied. A dozen men about us saw the blow. Tomorrow will be ample time, said the friend. It will not be ample time. Cried Sir Mulberry. Tonight, at once, here. His passion was so great that he could not articulate, but stood clenching his fist, tearing his hair, and stamping upon the ground. What is this, my lord? Said one of those who surrounded him. Have blows passed? One blow has, was the panting reply. I struck him. I proclaim it to all here. I struck him, and he knows why. I say, with him, let this quarrel be adjusted now. Captain Adams, said the young lord, looking hurriedly about him, and addressing one of those who had interposed. Let me speak with you, I beg. apostrophe, the person addressed stepped forward, and taking the young man's arm, they retired together, followed shortly afterwards by Sir Mulberry and his friend. It was a profligate haunt of the worst repute, and not a place in which such an affair was likely to awaken any sympathy for either party, or to call forth any further remonstrance or interposition. Elsewhere, its further progress would have been instantly prevented, and time allowed for sober and cool reflection. But not there. Disturbed in their orgies, the party broke up. Some reeled away with looks of tipsy gravity. Others withdrew noisily discussing what had just occurred. The gentlemen of honor who lived upon their winnings remarked to each other, as they went out, that Hawk was a good shot, and those who had been most noisy, fell fast asleep upon the sofas, and thought no more about it. Meanwhile, the two seconds, as they may be called now, after a long conference, each with his principal, met together in another room. Both utterly heartless, both men upon town, both thoroughly initiated in its worst vices, both deeply in debt, both fallen from some higher estate, both addicted to every depravity for which society can find some genteel name, and plead its most depraving conventionalities as an excuse, they were naturally gentlemen of most unblemished honor themselves, and of great nicety concerning the honor of other people. These two gentlemen were unusually cheerful just now, for the affair was pretty certain to make some noise, and could scarcely fail to enhance their reputations. "This is an awkward affair, Adams," apostrophe said Mr. Westwood, drawing himself up. "Very," apostrophe returned the captain. "A blow has been struck, and there is but one course, of course. Apostrophe, no apology, I suppose?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Westwood. "Not a syllable, sir, from my man, if we talk till doomsday," apostrophe returned the captain. "The original cause of dispute, I understand, was some girl or other, to whom your principal applied certain terms, which Lord Frederick, defending the girl, repelled. But this led to a long recrimination upon a great many sore subjects, charges, and countercharges. Sir Mulberry was sarcastic. Lord Frederick was excited, and struck him in the heat of provocation, and under circumstances of great aggravation. That blow, unless there is a full retraction on the part of Sir Mulberry, Lord Frederick is ready to justify. Apostrophe, there is no more to be said, apostrophe returned the other, but to settle the hour and the place of meeting. It's a responsibility, but there is a strong feeling to have it over. Do you object to say at sunrise?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, sharp work, apostrophe replied the captain, referring to his watch. "However, as this seems to have been a long time breeding, and negotiation is only a waste of words, no. Apostrophe, something may possibly be said, out of doors, after what passed in the other room, which renders it desirable, that we should be off without delay, and quite clear of town," apostrophe said Mr. Westwood. "What do you say to one of the meadows opposite Twickenham, by the riverside?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, the captain saw no objection. "Shall we join company in the avenue of trees which leads from Petersham to Ham House, and settle the exact spot when we arrive there?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Westwood. To this the captain also assented. After a few other preliminaries, equally brief, and having settled the road each party should take to avoid suspicion, they separated. "We shall just have comfortable time, my lord," apostrophe said the captain, when he had communicated the arrangements, "to call at my rooms for a case of pistols, and then jog coolly down. If you will allow me to dismiss your servant, we'll take my cab, for yours, perhaps, might be recognized." Apostrophe, what a contrast, when they reached the street, to the scene they had just left. It was already daybreak. For the flaring yellow light within, was substituted the clear, bright, glorious morning, for a hot, close atmosphere, tainted with the smell of expiring lamps, and reeking with the steams of riot and dissipation, the free, fresh, wholesome air. But to the fevered head on which that cool air blew, it seemed to come laden with remorse for time misspent and countless opportunities neglected. With throbbing veins and burning skin, eyes wild and heavy, thoughts hurried and disordered, he felt as though the light were a reproach, and shrunk involuntarily from the day, as if he were some foul and hideous thing. Shivering? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said the captain. You are cold. Apostrophe, rather. Apostrophe, it does strike cool, coming out of those hot rooms. Wrap that cloak about you. So, now we're off. Apostrophe, they rattled through the quiet streets, made their call at the captain's lodgings, cleared the town, and emerged upon the open road, without hindrance or molestation. Fields, trees, gardens, hedges, everything looked very beautiful. The young man scarcely seemed to have noticed them before, though he had passed the same objects a thousand times. There was a peace and serenity upon them all, strangely at variance with the bewilderment and confusion of his own half-sobered thoughts, and yet impressive and welcome. He had no fear upon his mind, but, as he looked about him, he had less anger. And though all old delusions, relative to his worthless late companion, were now cleared away, he rather wished he had never known him than thought of its having come to this. The past night, the day before, and many other days and nights beside, all mingled themselves up in one unintelligible and senseless whirl. He could not separate the transactions of one time from those of another. Now, the noise of the wheels resolved itself into some wild tune in which he could recognize scraps of airs he knew. Now, there was nothing in his ears, but a stunning and bewildering sound, like rushing water. But his companion rallied him on being so silent, and they talked and laughed boisterously. When they stopped, he was a little surprised to find himself in the act of smoking, but, on reflection, he remembered when and where he had taken the cigar. They stopped at the avenue gate and alighted, leaving the carriage to the care of the servant, who was a smart fellow, and nearly as well accustomed to such proceedings as his master. Sir Mulberry and his friend were already there. All four walked in profound silence up the aisle of stately elm trees, which, meeting far above their heads, formed a long green perspective of Gothic arches, terminating, like some old ruin, in the open sky. After a pause, and a brief conference between the seconds, they, at length, turned to the right, and taking a track across a little meadow, passed Ham House, and came into some fields beyond. In one of these, they stopped. The ground was measured, some usual forms gone through, the two principals were placed front, to front at the distance agreed upon, and Sir Mulberry turned his face towards his young adversary for the first time. He was very pale, his eyes were bloodshot, his dress disordered, and his hair disheveled. For the face, it expressed nothing but violent and evil passions. He shaded his eyes with his hand, grazed at his opponent, steadfastly, for a few moments, and, then taking the weapon which was tendered to him, bent his eyes upon that, and looked up no more until the word was given, when he instantly fired. The two shots were fired, as nearly as possible, at the same instant. In that instant, the young lord turned his head sharply. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.